Okay, let's pick up where we left off in 1 Kings. We left off in chapter 13. And for those of you who haven't been here when we started this book, just keep something in mind when we're going through these next two couple of chapters tonight. The kingdom has now been split from the north and the south. And you got the son of Solomon, Rehoboam. He's the one that's now the king of the southern tribes. He's the king of Judah and Benjamin down in the south. Okay, now the whole kingdom has been split because of the judgments that God has brought upon Israel because of Solomon's sin. And you got Jeroboam. He's the one who became king in the northern sector. That's where this thing picks up. And I think it's very, very insightful. And there's a lot of, I think, instruction to be gleaned from this. But beginning with that verse 1 in chapter 13 of 1 Kings, it says, I'm going to read this whole chapter because I don't want to break up the story. Then we'll go back and break it down. In verse 1 it says, Now behold, there came a man of God from Judah to Bethel by the word of the Lord while Jeroboam was standing at the altar to burn incense. And he cried against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, Behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and human bones shall be burned on you. Then he gave a sign the same day, saying, This is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall be split apart, and its ashes which are on it shall be poured out. Now it came about when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar of Bethel, that Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, Seize him. But his hand which he stretched out against him dried up, so that he could not draw it back to himself. And the altar also was split apart, and the ashes were poured out from the altar, according to the sign which the man of God had given by the word of the Lord. And the king answered and said to the man of God, Please entreat the Lord your God, and pray for me, that my hand might be restored to me. So the man of God entreated the Lord, and the king's hand was restored to him, and it became as it was before. Then the king said to the man of God, Come home with me and refresh yourself, and I will give you a reward. But the man of God said to the king, If you were to give me half your house, I would not go with you, nor would I eat bread or drink water in this place. For so it was commanded me by the word of the Lord, saying, You shall eat no bread, nor drink water, nor return by the way which you came. So he went another way and did not return by the way which he came to Bethel. Now an old prophet was living in Bethel, and his sons came to, and told him all the deeds the man of God had done that day in Bethel, and the words which he had spoken to the king. These also they related to their father. Then their father said to them, Which way did he go? Now his sons had seen the way which the man of God, who came from Judah, had gone. Then he said to his sons, Saddle your donkey for me. So they saddled the donkey for him, and he rode away on it. So he went after the man of God and found him sitting under an oak. And he said to him, Are you the man of God who came from Judah? And he said, I am. And then he said to him, Come home with me and eat bread. And he said, I cannot return with you, nor go with you, nor will I eat bread or drink water with you in this place. For a command came to me from the word of the Lord. You shall not eat bread nor drink water there, nor do not return by going the way which you came. And he said to him, I am also a prophet like you. And an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, Bring him back with you to your house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied to him. So he went back with him and ate bread in his house and drank water. Now it came about as they were sitting down at the table that the word of the Lord came to the prophet who had brought him back. And he cried to the man of God who came to him from Judah, saying, Thus saith the Lord, because you have disobeyed the command of the Lord, and have not observed the commandment which the Lord your God commanded you, but have returned and eaten bread and drunk water in this place, which he said to you, Eat no bread and drink no water, your body shall not come to the grave of your fathers. And it came about that after he had eaten bread and after he had drunk, that he saddled his donkey for him, for the prophet whom he had brought back. Now when he had gone, a lion met him on the way and killed him, and his body was thrown on the road with the donkey standing beside it, and the lion also was standing beside the body. And behold, men passed by and saw the body thrown on the road, and the lion was standing beside the body, so that they came and told it in the city where the old prophet lived. And when the prophet who had brought him back from the way heard it, he said, It is the man of God who disobeyed the command of the Lord. Therefore the Lord has given him to the lion, which he has torn him and killed him, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke to him. Then he spoke to his son, saying, saddle the donkey for me, and they saddled it. And he went and found the body thrown on the road with the donkey and the lion standing beside the body. The lion had not eaten the body nor torn the donkey. So the prophet took up the body of the man, and he laid it on the donkey and brought it back, and he came to the city of the old prophet to mourn and to bury him. And he laid his body in his own grave, and they mourned over him, saying, alas, my brother. And it came about after he had buried him that he spoke to his son, saying, when I die, bury me in the grave in which the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones, for the thing shall surely come to pass which he cried by the word of the Lord against the altar of Bethel, against all the houses of the high places which are in the cities of Samaria. After this event, Jeroboam did not return from his evil way, but again he made priests on the high places, and from among all the people, any who would, he ordained to be priests of the high places. And this event became sin to the house of Jeroboam, even to blot it out and destroy it from the face of the earth. Now, the reason I read that whole 34 verses is because I didn't want to break up this story. Because to me, this is a very, very instructive story. It's a fascinating story, but I think there's a lot to be gleaned from the story. But first of all, just keep this in mind so you get this proper perspective. The kingdom has been split. Jeroboam was told specifically by the prophet Ahijah that God was going to give him the northern kingdom. And God told Jeroboam, saying, listen, if you will walk in my ways and do what I tell you to do, if you follow my commandments and do my statutes and my ordinances, he said, I will establish your throne forever, and I will bless you. That's what God promised him. But here's the problem. Once Jeroboam, he was up here in Samaria, he's ruling these 10 tribes up here, and down here in Judah, there's Solomon's son, Rehoboam, he's ruling the southern tribe. But here's the problem. God gave specific commandments to his people through Moses that 3 times a year, all the males were to go down to Jerusalem to worship God. And they were to do it, of course, on the Passover, also known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And they were to do it the Feast of Booths, or otherwise known as the Feast of Tabernacles. And they would do it on the Feast of Harvest, which would have been referred to as Pentecost. Okay, they had to go down there 3 times a year, but Jeroboam thought to himself, you know what, I don't want people going down to worship down there in Jerusalem, because if they do, they're liable to, over a period of time, begin to feel more of a loyalty to Rehoboam down there, and they're liable to assassinate me, and I'm going to lose my kingdom. So he came up with this plan. He figured, well, I'm going to tell people, look, you don't have to go down to Jerusalem to worship God. You don't have to go there. And so what he did, he set up a temple up there in Dan, and an altar up there, with a golden calf in it. All right. Now, this wasn't a whole new god or a whole new idol or anything like that. This was supposed to represent the God of heaven. All right. The same God that brought them out of Egypt and set them free. The same God that gave them the whole land of Cana. All right. He set up an altar up there in Dan. He set one right down here in Bethel, which is, probably 10 miles from Jerusalem. So anyway, what I'm saying is this. Jeroboam did this because he felt like, I'm going to make it really convenient for people not to go down to Jerusalem. People are going to come in lockstep with me because they're going to figure, why do we have to go all the way down there? Especially people that live up here in the north. They had to make a long trek here, and that was quite a way. 7,500 miles that they'd have to come 3 times a year to come to worship the Lord. So he made it real convenient for them, saying, hey, all you have to do is just go worship the same God, but what we'll do is we'll just set up a different place. And that's the place you can worship God at, right? But God specifically gave them instructions. He gave it through Moses in various places. But in the book of Deuteronomy, God specifically told his people in the 12th chapter of Deuteronomy, I won't read the whole thing, but God said this, but you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God shall choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and you shall come, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithe and your contributions from your hand and your votive offerings and your freewill offerings and your firstborn of your herd and of your flocks, and there you and your household shall eat before the Lord your God and rejoice in all your undertakings which the Lord your God has blessed you with. And you shall not do at all what we are doing here today, every man whatever is right in his own eyes, for you have not just... Anyway, he just goes on, he says it again. He says several times that you are to only worship in the place that I choose. Now, I don't know how many people were sleeping when we went through the various portions of Scripture where God had chosen this various place. How did God choose this place, Jerusalem? Anybody remember?
the threshing floor of Onan?
Yeah, it was when David had went and made a census. When he got out of God's will, he was taking a census to see how many people he was ruling over. And as a punishment, God specifically said to him, hey, you can have 3 years of famine or 3 months being defeated before your enemies or 3 days of pestilence. And David was hard pressed about that. And he said, well, let me fall into the hands of God rather than fall into the hands of man. Because God's so much more merciful. Well, God sent 3 days of pestilence, and 70,000 people lost their lives over that. But the angel with the drawn flaming sword, he was over Jerusalem and pointing at the threshing floor of Ornan. And that's where God said, that's where I want my temple built. All right? Now, God gave specific instructions. Where I place my temple, that's where I want you to worship. And because God didn't want everybody just doing their own thing, worshiping how God, you know, sacrificing to God every which way they wanted, wherever they wanted, whatever place they wanted, okay? And God that made that abundantly clear. But here's the thing, too. When you went through the Gospel of John, where Jesus met the woman of Samaria, remember what that woman asked Jesus when she said, the woman said to him, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worship in this mountain, and you people say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall you worship the Father. He said, you worship that which you do not know. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and truth. For such people the Father seeks to be his worshipers. Now, Jesus kind of set that record straight. When the woman of Samaria asked him, he says, you Jews worship down there in Jerusalem, but we Samaritans worship up on this mountain over here. Who's right? And Jesus said, hey, you guys are worshiping in ignorance. The Jews are right. That's where God chose to place his name. Now, the reason I went through this whole explanation here is because you got to get it right in your mind why it was so important to God that people go down there 3 times a year, that they worship the Lord down there. Because he knew that if people just were worshiping any place they wanted to worship, then they were going to eventually start inculcating a lot of pagan ideas and ceremonies and rituals and their own beliefs and their own way of doing things. He wanted them to go down there where the priest himself would offer the sacrifice on their behalf. So what Jeroboam, for political reasons, he decided he was going to, you know, make it convenient for the people because he didn't want them going down to Jerusalem. But here's the thing. Jeroboam, if he really believed God, if he really trusted God, if he really put his faith in God, you know, he just would have said, look, I don't like the idea of everybody in my kingdom going down to Jerusalem and Rehoboam's kingdom to worship because they're liable to turn on me, but I'm going to trust God in this. I'm going to believe God in this. I'm going to go down there myself, even though I may be a marked man and maybe even assassinated. I'm going to leave my life into God's hands. I'm going to leave this position in God's hands because God promised me this. Now, see, that would have been stepping out of faith, and that would have been believing God, right? Instead, he figures he's got to manipulate the whole situation and force the whole situation to his own advantage. And look what he does. He institutes a situation where he causes God's people to sin in a very, very profound way, in such a way that it's going to lead them into idolatry and it's going to eventually lead them into destruction. That's where he's coming from. Now, this prophet, God sends this prophet from Jerusalem, he sends him up here to Bethel. This is, you know, here's Jerusalem right here, all right, and this prophet is probably from Judah. He goes up to Bethel to pronounce a curse on this altar when Jeroboam decides that he's going to initiate this whole idolatrous worship. But he's saying, hey, we can worship God anywhere that we want because God is not confined to one place. And that's true, right? But you see, he's mixing truth with error and he's misleading his people for his own political ends and his own purposes, all right? Well, the guy, this unnamed prophet, as a matter of fact, in the writing of Josephus, I won't read this the whole thing, but Josephus says that this particular guy's name, this prophet, this unnamed prophet, his name is Jadon, that goes there to pronounce a judgment on this altar. And the way that Jeroboam had set this up, he set it up right around one of these feast days that the Jews were supposed to go down to Jerusalem. So he just was hell-bent on doing it in such a way that it would just make it really convenient for people not to obey God in order to keep his kingdom. And then this unnamed prophet goes up there, and what does he do? Look what the judgment that this unnamed prophet pronounces on this man, because I think it's really, really insightful and very, I think, profound. Because look at that verse 2. This is the prophet that God sends against Jeroboam. He says, "And he cried against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and human bones shall be burned on you." Now, you know what's fascinating about this? God pronounces through this prophet a king of Judah who will arise, and his name is going to be Josiah. And he's going to end up taking a lot of the bones of the priests who are offering these sacrifices on these false altars. He's going to take their bones and he's going to burn them on these altars, the priests' bones themselves. All right? That's what he's pronouncing. Now, interesting thing, Josiah doesn't come upon the scene till almost 300 years after this prophecy. Almost 80 years after God judges the whole northern kingdom into exile by the Assyrians because of this very thing. They got away from God. Now, he's talking about this guy, Josiah. God predicts this guy by name. Look at that. Josiah by name. God even names the guy 300 years before he carries this out. Anybody remember when we went through Isaiah where God predicted the coming of a king? 200 years before he was born, and God named it by name. Anybody remember who the king was? It was Cyrus. That God said that he was going to use Cyrus. And Cyrus was a Persian king that God used to end up getting his people back into their land. But here's two examples where God mentions individuals by name who are going to be born, who are going to perform certain acts centuries before they're even born. Now, put two and two together. What does that tell you about abortion? When God knows these people by name, God said to Jeremiah, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you." Anybody with any intellectual honesty has got to look at this and say, man, we are way over the top when we start murdering unborn children. When you look at a situation like this, when God knows them by name before they're even born, centuries before they're even born. So this Josiah, he comes on the scene, and I won't read that whole thing, but you can see the fulfillment of it in 2 Kings chapter 23, where we read about Josiah, and it says the fulfillment of this prophecy. It says, "Furthermore, the altar that was at Bethel in the high place, which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin, had made, even that altar in the high place, he," that's Josiah, "broke down. And he demolished its stones and ground them to dust and burned to Asherah." That's Asherah was a female goddess, or deity. She was a female goddess of sex. It says, "Now when Josiah turned, he saw the graves that were there on the mountain, and he sent and took the bones from the graves and burned them on the altar and defiled it according to the word of the Lord, which the man of God proclaimed, who proclaimed these things." The fulfillment of this prophecy by this unknown prophet was being fulfilled right to the letter, isn't it? Right to the T. 300 years later, almost 300 years later. And he says, and he said, Josiah says, "What is this monument I see?" And the men of the city told him, "It is the grave of the man of God who came from Judah and proclaimed these things which you have done against the altar of Bethel." And he said, "Let him alone, let no one disturb his bones." So they left his bones undisturbed with the bones of the prophet who came from Samaria. And then it goes on, it just talks about many of the other things that Josiah had done. You know, he instituted the Passover again because the people had fallen into such idolatry and the temple had become so dilapidated and it became so inculcated with the pagan worship and idols and stuff like this. And Josiah had the temple remodeled, rebuilt, reinstituted the Passover. Another thing it says, "Moreover, Josiah removed the mediums and the spiritists and the teraphim," which were like totem pole idols, he says, "and the idols from all the abominations that were set in the land of Judah and in Jerusalem, that he might confirm the words of the law which were written in the book of Hilkiah, the priest found in the house of the Lord. And before him there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all of his heart and with all of his soul and with all of his might according to the law of Moses, nor did any like him arise after him." Now this is a standard that God has set when it came to the kings of Judah and also the kings in Samaria. I think Samaria had something like 22 kings, and the northern kingdom had something like 22 kings, and none of them were any good. And I think the northern kingdom, or the southern kingdom rather, had about 18 kings, and about 8 of them were decent. But the standard was David. If they were kings like David, then they were good men. Look at this Josiah. Isn't he quite an exception? I think his name is means something like the Lord helps, you know, or the Lord will reconstruct or something like that. This Josiah was quite a king. He became a king when he was like, if I'm not mistaken, he was 8 years old. His father got killed. His father was a worthless good for nothing. His grandfather, Manasseh, was the absolute worst king that Judah ever had. He reigned 55 years, and he inculcated so much idolatry and immorality and ungodliness. And then he reigned a long time, and he was the most wicked king that Judah had ever seen. And look at his grandson. What does that say to you about Josiah? Josiah had a mother that I'm assuming was a godly woman, and she raised him up in the love and the knowledge and fear of God. In spite of all of the bad influences that he had, apparently he had a godly mother who really taught him about the Lord. And when he was 16 years old, Josiah was 16 years old, it says that he really began to seek God with all of his heart. And when he's around 23, 26 years old, if I'm not mistaken, that's when he had the temple, you know, rebuilt and cleansed, and that they found a scroll that was hidden in some of the walls of the temple, and it pronounced a tremendous judgment that was going to come upon Judah or Jerusalem because of the people's wickedness. And when Josiah heard that, he tore his clothes, rent his robe, rather, and he sent to Huldah. I think it was Huldah who was a prophetess, and he asked her about the scroll, and she said, yeah, this is going to come to pass, but God says, because you had such a tender heart towards me, it's not going to happen in your lifetime, that you're going to go down in peace. You know, and God eventually brought the Babylonians down in fulfillment of destroying the southern tribe. But what's interesting is this fascinating story about this unnamed prophet. Like I said, Josephus calls him Jadon. And that's neither here nor there, because I don't put a whole lot of confidence in what Josephus writes, even though I get a lot out of what he wrote. But I don't look at it as being divinely inspired. But this is otherwise an unknown prophet, and look what he does. He has a tremendous victory, because he goes there, and just when the king is going to offer up the sacrifice on his altar, what does this unnamed prophet do? I mean, he stands up in front of all these people, and he just pronounces his judgment. I mean, this took a lot of courage, didn't it? It took a lot of guts. He says, altar, altar, thus saith the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and on you shall sacrifice to the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and human bones will be burned on you. That was a fulfillment that I just read there in 2 Kings 23, right? He says, then he gave a sign the same day, saying, this is the sign which the Lord has spoken. Behold, the altar shall split apart, and its ashes which are on it shall be poured out. Now it came about when the king heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried against the altar in Bethel, that Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, seize him. But his hand in which he stretched out against him dried up, so that he could not draw back. In other words, the king is there, and all his pomp and all his ceremony, he got all these people around. And this prophet just blurts out this prophecy against him, and then Jeroboam is just livid. He's red-faced with indignation. He's just ticked off. He points at the guy. He says, seize that man. As soon as he does it, his hand just withers up, and he panics. He just panics. He says, oh, man, pray to God that he will heal my arm. I'll heal my hand. And the prophet prays to God, he heals it. And talk about conviction. And the guy, he's saying, man, this guy really is a man of God. And the altar is just splitting in half there, and all the ashes poured out, exactly like he prophesied. So what does Jeroboam say? He says to the guy, hey, come on home with me. Come home with me, and I'll give you something to eat, and I'll give you a great reward. Now, see what happens is, rather than Jeroboam saying, you know what? I'm under profound conviction here, man, and telling his people, look, I've made a horrendous mistake. This is obviously not what God wants. You all need to go down to Jerusalem and worship. Instead, he tries to put this prophet in a compromising position, because if the prophet went home with Jeroboam, it would kind of suggest to everybody else, well, you know, that this whole thing wasn't so bad after all, because now the king and this prophet are now buddies. Now they're chum. But the prophet says to him, what? God told me no. He says, if you're going to give me half your kingdom, I couldn't go with you. He says, because I'm not supposed to eat or drink anything in this place, and I'm supposed to go back a different way. Now, why do you think God put that restriction on the prophet, that he could not eat or drink?
He doesn't become buddy with him, and then he pronounced judgment onto eventually?
Well, put it this way. What is eating and drinking very often coincide?
Fellowship.
Celebration. Food is very often, you know, associated with celebrations, right? So God wants it abundantly clear that, hey man, this is no time to celebrate. This is no time to fellowship. This is no time to have a party. This is time for fasting and praying and mourning and weeping, because this is a horrendous sin that's going to lead this whole nation into captivity and under my divine judgment. That's why God put that restriction on him. It wasn't like God just arbitrarily just said, well, I'm going to make it a little bit difficult for you. But it really wasn't that difficult. I mean, if you look at where Jerusalem is and where Bethel is, it's about 10 miles. I mean, at max, maybe 15 miles. But if the guy has a donkey, I mean, it's not that bad of a deal if he goes up there and comes back the same day. But the guy has a tremendous victory, doesn't he? Tremendous. But then, right after his tremendous victory, now he's going to end up having a tremendous downfall. And then sometimes that can happen to pastors, ministers, priests, or people in spiritual leadership. They can have a tremendous victory, and then they let their guard down. And that's when the devil will come right in and just hit them from a blind side and just really bring them down. And that's exactly what happened to this prophet. Because what does this guy do? It's really interesting that once he refuses to have dinner or lunch or whatever with the king, he says, I'm even supposed to go back a different way, which kind of suggests to me that God didn't want to give any occasion for you to be familiar with anybody. You got very specific instruction. You make a beeline up there and a beeline back. Don't dilly-dally and just get, you know, do your job and get back. Well, what's the guy do? He goes up there and he has this tremendous victory, and now it seems like he's lollygagging along, going back a different way, he's being obedient, but now he's sitting under an oak tree. You know, I'm not trying to be too uncharitable to the guy, but I think he should have just made a beeline right back to where he came from and not sit around and see this thing through completely. But he's sitting down, taking his ease, and then what happens? It says the two guys that were there, and they witnessed this whole thing, they go home and tell their father, man, you should have seen what happened. There was a prophet of God, he came from Jerusalem, he said such and such and so and so, did this and that and the other thing. And then the old man, he's an old prophet, you know, like an old preacher or whatever, he's like, oh, really? Well, which way did he go? He saddles his donkey, lights out after him and finds him, right? And then, what does this guy say to him? Because, man, I think this is pretty darn instruction, because look at that verse 14. So he went after the man of God and found him sitting under an oak, and he said to him, are you the man of God who came from Judah? And he said, I am. Then he said to him, come home with me and eat bread. And he said, I cannot return with you, nor go with you, nor will I eat bread or drink water in this place, for a command came to me from the word of the Lord, you shall not eat bread nor drink water there, nor return by going the way which you came. And he said to him, I also am a prophet like you, or you could say almost substitute, I'm also a preacher like you. And an angel spoke to me by the word of the Lord, saying, bring him back to your house that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied to him. And then what happened? So in verse 19, so he went back with him and he ate bread in his house. Now, the old guy lied to him. He's a prophet of God, but look, he lied to him. Why would a guy lie to him? He really wants to fellowship with this guy. He really wants to be with him, because he's like, hey, let's talk over old times. I'll tell you what God did through me, this situation, that situation, right? Yeah. He really wants, you know, to have some companionship here, some fellowship, talk over war stories or whatever. You see what I'm saying? And so he lies to him because he wants so bad to get to know this guy. And the guy falls for it. But here's the thing, all right? Verse 20, now it came about when they were sitting down at the table that the word of the Lord came to the prophet who had brought him back, and he cried out to the man of God who came to him from Judah, saying, thus saith the Lord, because you have disobeyed the commandment of the Lord and have not observed the command which the Lord your God commanded you, but have returned and eaten and drunken water in this place, which the Lord said to you, eat no bread and drink no water, your body shall not come to the grave of your fathers. And it came about after he had eaten and read and after he had drunk that he saddled the donkey for him, for the prophet whom he had brought back. And then what happened there? In that verse 24, when he had gone, a lion met him on the way and killed him. What are we told in Peter? He says, your adversary, the devil, the Satan, is going about as a roaring lion seeking whom he could devour. Mm. You see what happens when we disobey God? We put ourselves right in his crosshairs. Mm. All right? He's going to bring us down because of disobedience. And that's exactly what happens to this guy. The lion kills the man. But what shows the supernatural element to this?
didn't devour either him or the donkey.
Right. The donkey standing there, you'd think that donkey would have hightailed it out to Samaria somewhere. But the donkey's just standing there. I guess he's eating hay while the lion's right next to him. I mean, that is totally, solely unnatural. And the lion is not devouring the man. He's not attacking the donkey. So that shows you, hey, man, God's hands is in this thing. No question about it. God is showing, hey, this is a judgment from me. All right, and this judgment is brought about by this man's disobedience. And when we disobey God, what does it do? It opens us up to, I think, demonic influence or attack or whatever. And this is what happened to this guy. But, you know, the old man, the old prophet, he yells out, he blurts out a prophecy. Now, I don't believe this guy had control over what he was saying because God's speaking through him. Remember how God spoke to Balaam? He spoke to him through the mouth of a jackass, right? His jackass spoke to him three times, and Balaam answered him three times. The donkey probably wasn't cognizant of what he was saying. God just used him to speak his word. So he's using this jackass of an old prophet to speak his word to this man. And it's a judgment, right? And God can use, you can use a jackass all the time. People call me a jackass all the time, you know, but it doesn't matter. God can use me to speak his word. It doesn't matter what God uses to speak through. And, you know, you ever see these tabloids in the supermarket? I see them all day long because I work right there in the supermarket. It amazes me the number of tabloids, even though they're just a joke in many respects, and they're just the same old rehash, still, it always amazes me the number of times that you will read on these things about judgment coming, the end of the world coming, this, that, and I'm thinking to myself, there's God speaking his word through the mouth of a jackass. Again, yeah. It's like, hey, people won't listen to God. They won't listen to his servants. They won't listen to the preacher. They won't listen to his word. So God said, well, here, maybe I can have a jackass speak to you. Maybe that'll save your soul. See what happens here? You see this situation where God uses his prophet who lied to him to pronounce this judgment. And then what happens to the guy? What did that prophet say to him? What did the old prophet say to the man? He said, an angel said to me. Isn't that insightful? Okay, look at that verse 18. And he said to him, the old man said to him, the old prophet said to him, I am a prophet like you, and an angel spoke to me by way of the Lord, saying, bring him back with you. Right? An angel. He says an angel told him to tell him that. Right? What are we told in Corinthians, and what are we told in Galatians, where Paul says this, all right, because this is very important. Paul says in Galatians chapter 1, he says this, I am amazed that you are so quickly deserting him who called you by the grace of Christ for a different gospel, which is really not another gospel, only there are some who are disturbing you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. But even though we, or an angel from heaven, should preach to you a gospel contrary to that which you have preached to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so I am saying again now, if any man is preaching to you a gospel contrary to that which you have received, let him be accursed. He also says something very similar to that in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. Verse 13, where he says, for such men, he's talking about false prophets here, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workers, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ, and no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. Therefore, it is not surprising that if his servants are disguising themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their deeds. What are we reading here? Now you tell me. See, what God was trying to tell this prophet is that God does not contradict himself. Look at how many pastors and ministers and priests that we have in the pulpits today who are proclaiming, hey, you know what? Homosexuality is an acceptable lifestyle, and if you don't go along with this, then you are hateful, then you are a homophobe, that you are a fanatic, that you are dangerous. How many times do you hear this? Now, does God contradict himself? They're saying that, well, God is love and this is acceptable.
No, they're making it up themselves.
That's what I'm saying. Just like this prophet did, he lied to them. But yet people want to hear it. Because what are we told in Timothy? That Paul says, especially in the last days, men will be accumulating for themselves teachers for their own desires who will tickle their ears, tell them what they want to hear.
Yeah.
You see, this is what this prophet, this young prophet, wanted to hear. He got his ear tickled, right?
Yeah.
And so he didn't believe. So this is the judgment that came upon him. But then, just in concluding this chapter, it says that the old man, he went out and he got the young prophet, took him back, and he buried him in his grave, and he told his sons, look, when I die, I want you to bury me with this man, because this man was obviously a prophet of God. I'm sure he probably felt guilty for what he did, but they still had a bond together as far as being, you know, prophets. Anybody have anyone to add or share before we quickly go through this chapter 14?
I do.
I know half of you guys are sleeping already. Huh?
Not that I'm God or that I know anything, but it seems weird that
the other prophet wasn't the one that was punished.
Okay, you know what? That's good, very good point. But what did I read about? I just read it in Corinthians where Paul said this. He said it in Corinthians. Therefore, there is not surprising if his servants, he's talking about the angels of light or the devil, if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their deeds. In other words, God was going to judge him. All right? He didn't get away with this for his lying. Believe me, God was going to judge him. But in this circumstance, in the situation, God needed to judge this younger prophet first because he blew his witness. He blew his testimony. You know, he had such a great victory, and then he didn't see it through. Well, listen, I'll tell you what. Let's just quickly go through this chapter 14. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it because we only got about 20 minutes here. Okay, chapter 14, it says, at that time, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, became sick, and Jeroboam said to his wife, arise now and disguise yourself so that they may not know that you are the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh. Behold, Ahijah the prophet is there, who spoke concerning me that I would be king over this people. And take 10 loaves with you, and some cakes, and a jar of honey, and go to him, and he will tell you what will happen to the boy. And Jeroboam's wife did so, and arose and went to Shiloh, and came to the house of Ahijah. Now Ahijah could not see, for his eyes were dim because of his age. Now the Lord had said to Ahijah, behold, the wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire of you concerning her son, for he is sick. You shall say thus and thus to her, for it will be when she arrives that she will pretend to be another woman. And it came about when Ahijah heard the sound of her feet coming in the doorway that he said, come in, wife of Jeroboam, why do you pretend to be another woman? For I am sent to you with a harsh message. Go, say to Jeroboam, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you a leader over my people Israel and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and who followed me with all of his heart to do only that which is right in my sight. You also have done more evil than all who were before you and have gone and made for yourselves other gods and molten images to provoke me to anger and have cast me behind your back. Therefore, behold, I am bringing calamity on this house of Jeroboam, and I will cut off from Jeroboam every male person, both bond and free, in Israel, and I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam as one sweeps away dung until it is all gone. Anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs will eat, and he who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens will eat, for the Lord has spoken it. Now, you arise and go to your house, and when your feet enter the city, the child will die. And all of Israel shall mourn for him and bury him, for he alone of Jeroboam's family shall come to the grave, because in him something good was found towards the Lord God of Israel and the house of Jeroboam. Moreover, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam this day and from now on. For the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and he will uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to their fathers, and will scatter them beyond the Euphrates River, because they have made their Asherim, provoking the Lord to anger, and he will give up Israel on account of the sins of Jeroboam which he committed, and which he made Israel sin. Then Jeroboam's wife arose and departed, and came to Tisra. And she was entering the threshold of the house, and the child died. And all of Israel buried him and mourned for him according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke through his servant Ahijah the prophet. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he made war and how he reigned, behold, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And the time that Jeroboam reigned was 22 years, and he slept with his father Nadab. His son reigned in his place. Now, before we go any further, I just want to comment briefly on the situation with Jeroboam. Look what happens to the guy. Now he has a son. I don't know how old this child is. He's probably not a little child. He's probably, you know, 10, 11, 12 or something like that. But he's next in line for the throne. He becomes deathly sick. So what does Jeroboam do? He tells his wife, hey, tell you what, go disguise yourself and go to Ahijah. Who remembers who Ahijah was?
He was the one who had told Jeroboam that he would inherit.
Right. He was the prophet that God used to tell Jeroboam that he was going to give him the kingdom. Because when Ahijah went there, he had this cloak. He tore his cloak into 12 pieces, gave 10 pieces to Jeroboam, and said, thus saith the Lord, he's going to give you the 10 tribes of Israel. Okay? So Jeroboam knew that this man was a prophet. But why do you think he tells his wife, disguise yourself? Pretend you're another woman and just inquire about our son.
maybe he thought this was a judgment and he didn't want the prophet to know that.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, all right? The obviously, Jeroboam knew, especially when he had that unnamed prophet come to him and pronounce a judgment upon him. Jeroboam knew that, hey, man, I haven't been obedient to God. But I want to find out from God's servant what's going to be the outcome of my son. And maybe we can get him to pray for his son. His son's name was Abijah. He figured that maybe, you know, he would be able to, since he was a man of God, he'd be able to pray for him or restore his son or whatever. He wanted to find out what was going to happen to his son. But he wants his wife to disguise himself because he knows he hasn't been living for the Lord. This is very typical, I think. We just read this previous chapter here where God was going to bring tremendous judgment upon the northern tribes of Israel because of all the sins of Jeroboam. And here he is, a politician who misled his people, right? And the people went right along with it. How many politicians do we have now that are misleading us in a spiritual sense? And the people want this. The people want this. If a politician stands up and says, you know what, abortion is murder, and we're going to do everything in our power to do away with this hideous crime against God and humanity, you know, he's going to be shot down by the people himself, not just the media, not just the entertainment industry, not just these buffoons that are running around, you know, proclaiming that they know it all. Hey, you know, most of the people are going to be opposed to that, all right? Same thing if you stand up and proclaim that homosexuality is a sin. What's going to happen to you as a politician? But here's what I'm saying about the country we live in. I don't know. I mean, I just picked this up. I read it last night. It's one of these period articles. I got Newsweek magazine. I don't know. This is the latest Newsweek magazine. Maybe some guys have heard of this. This is some of the stories are best told straight. On September 8th, Kathy Griffin, a broady, foul-mouthed comedian, accepted an Emmy Award for her reality show that's called My Life on the D-List. And in her acceptance speech, she explained that while other actors might thank Jesus for such an honor, she would consider it suck at Jesus. She exuberantly added, waving her statue in the air, "This award is my God now."
Oh my God!
Is this terrible? This is the world we live in now.
At least she's honest.
But the Hollywood, everybody's laughing. They think, "Oh, this is really funny. This is really great." But let me tell you something. There was I have to paraphrase this because I forget where I read this, but it was some historian that said something to the effect, maybe you guys have heard something like this before, but one of the historians has written, he says that this is what he sees in civilizations. He says that people will go from slavery or bondage to great faith, and they will go from great faith to courage and conflict, and from courage and conflict to freedom and liberty, and from freedom and liberty to prosperity and abundance, and from prosperity and abundance to spiritual apathy and indifference, and from spiritual apathy and indifference to forsaking God, and from forsaking God to evil and wickedness, and from evil and wickedness back to slavery and bondage. Well, where are we right now? We are past forsaking God. We are now in evil and wickedness, and that woman epitomizes, right? So where do you think we're going from here? We're going back into bondage,
yeah,
all right?
Exactly.
We're going back into
bondage.
Because
they don't take into consideration the blessings of their freedom that Almighty God has given them.
Right. What was it? William Penn, who said something like, "Those who will not be governed by God will be ruled by tyrants." And I'm telling you right now, the Antichrist is in the wings. We can see his shadow. He's right there. God's going to use this man to judge this world. He's going to bring it in tremendous bondage because of our wickedness. And yet, that just epitomizes it, this foul-mouthed woman, you know, who's got the audacity to say, "Suck at Jesus." She would never get away with that.
Sure.
Never
sure.
Get away with that, saying this about Allah, you know, Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad.
Why would she even have to use that divine name like that? She could have said anything, but now she takes the name of our Lord.
Yeah, but I gotta hand it to her, like Rachel said, at least she's honest. She says, "This award is my God now." Okay, anyway, we got to wind this down because we're almost out of time here.
John, another disguise would be like if somebody is in dire straits or some tragedy like this woman and Jeroboam's son on death's door. And how many times do you hear somebody in a situation like that? "God, you get me out of this. I promise you I'll do this and I'll make promises to God." When that's not their heart, they get out of that situation and their true heart comes, none of that comes to pass. So they're putting on a disguise before God.
Right.
When they do that.
That's a real good point. You know, I've been in prison ministries. I've been in and out of prisons and jails and juvenile hall and stuff like that, trying to witness to people and lead them to Christ. And they have what you call a jailhouse conversion, you know, when people, they end up in the slammer for something, then they take God serious. But when they get out from under some of the hot seats they manage to get themselves into, then they forget God. Well, you know, you're right. This is what this Jeroboam did. What did he do? His hand withered up. You know, he cries out to God, to God's prophet, pray for me. And then his hand is restored, and he goes right back to the same old thing. So God brings this judgment upon him, and God says, look at that verse 15, for the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water. He will uproot Israel from its good land, which he gave to their fathers, and will scatter them beyond the Euphrates River, because they have made their Asherim. What's the Asherim? It's a female deity that they would worship. It was a goddess of sex. Isn't that our God today in this country? It's provoking the Lord to anger. So where are we going? Anyway, he said there was something good in his son, Abijah. I don't know what it was. Maybe he had a heart for God somehow, and God gave him a decent burial, but he still took the kid's life. And, you know, God in his mercy sometimes will take people when they're young, because you know what it will do? It'll save them from going to hell.
It could save the parents.
Right.
Also.
Right. Well, I remember one time reading about it, this couple. They were a Christian couple. They lost their, I think it was a 2-year-old child. They were so distraught. They were so miserable. They were really struggling with their anger with God. They were just so angry and frustrated about the whole thing. And they felt like, well, we need a vacation. So they took a vacation to Palestine. They went over there. And they happened to be watching this little shepherd boy as he was leading his sheep. And he brought these sheep to a stream, and the sheep would not follow him across the stream. They would not follow him, no matter what he'd do. He'd call to him, call him, he wouldn't follow him. So the little shepherd boy went over, and he picked up the smallest ewe lamb in the whole flock, picked him up, put him on his shoulders, and walked across the stream. And then all the other sheep began to follow him. And God spoke to this couple's heart, and he says, you see that? You see that little boy there? He says, just like that little boy taking that sheep across that stream, I had to take your child across death. Because otherwise you wouldn't follow. So anyway, we have to wind this down. That verse 21 really says, now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen from all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. And his mother's name was Naamah the Ammonitess. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy more than all the other fathers had done, with the sins which they had committed. For they also built for themselves high places and sacred pillars and ashrams on every high hill and beneath every luxuriant tree. And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord dispossessed before the sons of Israel. Now it came about in the 5th year of the king Rehoboam that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and he took everything, even taking all the shields of gold which Solomon had made. So King Rehoboam made shields of bronze in their place and committed them to the care of the commanders of the guard who guarded the doorway of the king's house. And it happened as often as the king entered the house of the Lord that the guards would carry them and would bring them back into the guard's room. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually. And Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. And his mother's name was Naamah the Ammonitess. And Abijam, his son, became king in his place. Now, just in concluding, isn't this very instructive? Look at he's saying here. In the southern kingdom, what were they doing? The people started getting into idolatry, they started getting into all kinds of immoral practices, and they started to worship these Asherim, which was a female goddess of sex, but it was goddess fertility. In other words, in some of their pagan rites, they would actually have people copulate on these altars as a sign of fertility. They wanted to be very fertile, very prosperous in their cattle, in their flocks, in their children, and in their material possessions, this type of thing. It was all an occultic practice, right? And he said they were even male cult prostitutes. In other words, these were homosexuals that would be practicing this in these pagan ceremonies as well. So what did God do? What did God do to the southern kingdom when they got out of hand? He brings this Shishak out of Egypt. This king of Egypt, he brings him down there. And what does he do? He attacks Jerusalem, and he carries away all their gold, all their silver. And Solomon had made, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 200 golden shields. All right, and he put them in his palace, or this court palace that he had. And now, Rehoboam, he wanted those shields back so bad, but now he makes shields out of bronze instead of gold. And what does that say to you?
Well, the bronze stands for judgment. You're exchanging the glory of God for and his blessings for judgment.
Yeah. Not only that, what does shields represent, spiritually speaking?
Faith.
Faith, the shield of faith. We told that in Ephesians 6. Take up the shield of faith so that you can extinguish the fiery darts of the evil one. Right? Well, gold points to deity, okay? It points to godness, right? And so in a sense, you know, when people get away from God and God brings judgment, it's almost like their faith is stunted. Their growth is stunted. Now, God can salvage anything, and I'm not saying that people who get into gross sin and then repent, they're not going to go to heaven. But a lot of times what happens when we get into sin is that we lose our moral authority. Take, for example, this Ted Haggard, you know, this guy who was an evangelist just a couple, 3-4 months ago, when he was found out that he was having male homosexual activity going on with some male prostitute. Remember that? What happened to this guy? I'm sure he still has his faith, but he has forfeited his moral authority to lead, hasn't he?
You know, this is our biggest problem today in our country. We have worship materialism rather than the God that gives us our liberties and freedom.
Right. And just a concluding thought here. God brings this Pharaoh, this king of Egypt, to bring judgment upon the southern kingdom. Right now, we are in a war at two fronts. How are we doing in this war?
Terrible.
Isn't it sad? And I knew before we even stepped foot in Afghanistan or Iraq, I knew, hey, you know what? This is going to be a mess. You know, I was in Vietnam and I saw a mess, but I thought this is even going to be messier. We are up against a great evil. We are up against a horrendous evil. And the only way we're going to be victorious against this horrendous evil is if we get right with God. Because we have marched out there over the oceans to bring the battle to them, but we're not winning this battle. And I'm just saying, you know what? It's a judgment. It's a judgment from God. And it's, what is God trying to do? He's trying to get us to repent, all right, to turn to Him, and to give our whole heart, mind, soul, and strength back to Him. It says it in Chronicles, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, I'll heal their land. That's the only thing that's going to heal this country. It's the only thing.